Good morning, Tucson, and happy Monday to you. Welcome to another week here on 1030 The Voice and Tipping Point with me, your host, Zach Yenser. Every day, in-depth news and discussion about the people, ideas, and issues shaping the future of Tucson and our region. Today on Tipping Point, I'll debrief Nevada's results over the weekend. Bernie atop the Democratic field, and why doesn't he talk about how much his plan costs? I'll also give my take on the sanctuary city ban in the Arizona State Legislature last week, millennials showing more loyalty to employers than the generation before them, and the Californication of housing here on Tipping Point. 790-2040 is your live line opportunity to give us a call and join the conversation at any point. If you've called in before, you know that it's always more fun when you do. It's more fun for me. It's more fun for you. And I hope we get to have a conversation on the air because it's just you and I, Tucson, here in the beautiful 1030 The Voice studio here on this beautiful Monday morning after a rainy weekend. I hope you enjoyed that as well. It was nice to kind of have a little bit of a different weekend. But let's jump in. Let's start with the sanctuary city ban in the Arizona State Legislature last week, I guess I should say the taking off of the ban that was being proposed. So let's start from the beginning. How did we get here? I want to give you my take on this, and here's what happened, and we remember it after at Governor Doug Ducey's state of the state. What he basically wanted to do, especially post Tucson's efforts in 2019, Tucson Families Free and Together, also known as the Sanctuary City legislation on the City of Tucson ballot in 2019, was to basically enshrine in the Arizona Constitution the wording that would preclude any city from adopting such policies. I like how I think it was Howard Fisher in the Star summarized that last week, to basically, instead of leaving it up to the voters long term, to basically put into the Constitution for as long as it would take for the amendment to be taken back out again, to basically say that Arizona does not do sanctuary city policies, right? So last year, during the whole Tucson Families Free and Together movement, first getting it on the ballot and then voting on it, Governor Doug Ducey was clearly nervous about this. This was not what he wanted on the news, on the media for his state, and he made known as such. So that gets us to this legislative session, the state of the state, where both in Phoenix and in Tucson, Governor Doug Ducey said that one of his goals in this legislative session was to enshrine Arizona's anti-sanctuary city sentiments in the Arizona state constitution. Last week, it failed to get anywhere with the state legislature, and it was basically killed. They're not going to pursue it in the state legislature. So that gets us to today. Here's my take. I think it was a bad idea to stir the pot. No doubt. Again, we heard it in Tucson. The voter initiative, Tucson Families Free and Together, made him nervous. He stated it in no unclear terms that if Tucson were to go through with it, there would be consequences. And certainly a lot of the pro Tucson Families Free and Together movement supporters said it's kind of, we could lose money. The city attorney said that we would, that the state basically says if cities put in place laws that are against state law, we can withhold funding. Supporters of the sanctuary city movement said it's speculative at best. We don't really know if it'll happen. Anti-sanctuary city supporters said, no, we're going to lose hundreds of millions of dollars and we can't afford to do that. The Tucson voters ultimately voted it down 70% to 30%. I mean, it was crystal clear for whatever reason that this was not going to happen in Tucson. Of course, there would be consequences, right? SB 1070, Arizona state law. We just got into that. Here's what I found interesting. Here's one of the foundations of why I think it was a bad idea to stir the pot. There's a history of major Arizona cities pursuing sanctuary city status. And I found this interesting. I actually haven't heard this brought up before, but each Arizona city over the last 3 or 4 years in the, we'll call it the Trump era, and by that I mean 2016 on, in the last 4 years, Arizona's three major cities have tried to get sanctuary for their city. Back in 2017, the voters of Phoenix brought the sanctuary city idea to their mayor and council, which I think it's also interesting because we think of the great state of Maricopa as being red, 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 and to some degree it is still. But in 2017, when the voters of Phoenix brought Sanctuary City to mayor and council, it was a Democratic majority council. I was fascinated looking back on this, right? In quotes, one councilman said to supporters of Sanctuary City in 2017 in Phoenix, quote, "You are going to be very disappointed by the end of this," right? So the voters wanted to come before the city council and say, look, are we going to do this or not? Just give me a yay, just give me a nay. Where are we at on this? One councilman, a Democrat, said, "You're going to be very disappointed by the end of this." It gets more interesting, right? Now U.S. House Representative for District 9, then Mayor Greg Stanton, who the rumor mill is talking about might run for governor, said, quote, "This issue is settled as a matter of law. It was settled for Phoenix and any other Arizona city by Senate Bill 1070, unquote. Right? Greg Stanton is a Democrat. There is no question about it. He's not a dino. He's a Democrat. And it becomes more clear by the year that Greg Stanton is a Democrat. A Democratic city council in Phoenix in 2017 said, yeah, no. In May of 2018, the Arizona saga continues. Flagstaff's voters made a similar push without success. It was actually Tucson that was the third of three major Arizona cities. Maybe if I'm biased and I need to be including another city as a major city, give me a call, 790-2040. I don't intend to close anybody out, but in my mind, north is Flagstaff, central is Phoenix, south is Tucson. That's how I see it. In 2019, Tucson's voters were the last voters to take this issue before their city in a major legislative way. What's interesting is that Tucson's voters got it the furthest. They got on the ballot. It was voted on in November, but it turned out into what was basically a 70% to 30% denial of Sanctuary City in Tucson. So why do I think it was a bad idea to stir the pot? Why do I think it was a good idea that it got pulled in the state legislature? And a lot of people listening aren't going to like this, but this is the truth. This is the truth. Then candidate and now Mayor Rekena Romero was right in 2019, and she was right in 2020 when she said that if the voters of Arizona cities want change on this issue, if Arizona voters in their cities want a more friendlier immigrant policy, the change is with SB 1070, period. End of story. Everything else is frosting on the cake, is sprinkles on the ice cream. And you know what? This is a Mayor Rekena Romero quote. I think she nailed it in terms of policy. The root issue is SB 1070. Let me put it a different way. If you are pro sanctuary city, your challenge is SB 1070. If you are anti sanctuary city, your protection is SB 1070. So could sanctuary city be an issue that continues to come up in Arizona? Quite possibly, right? There's this interesting dynamic in Arizona where Arizona is one of the states in the union that is welcoming the most new residents than almost any other state in the country. Governor Doug Ducey talks about how California is our greatest economic development plan. That also means that we are moving in residents from the coasts. We're moving in residents from more expensive places, which often tend to be educated urban cores, which mean between that and our state on the cutting edge of becoming majority-minority in the next few years, it means Arizona is going to become purple. And yes, that means Maricopa as well. So if you're Governor Doug Ducey and you don't want your state to be in the media for sanctuary, yes, it's a concern that it could come up again. But here's the thing. This constitutional amendment that Governor Doug Ducey mentioned in his State of the City in Phoenix and in Tucson was not going to change the spirit of what's possible through SB 1070. Here's what his communications guy said last week in the wake of this legislation not even really taking off in the legislature. Both immigrant groups, by the way, and business interests in the state both either said it was a bad idea or thanked him for pulling it, which was interesting. At the same time, and I'm quoting from how the Star wrote it, but it's a quote of Governor Doug Ducey's communications guy. At the same time, quote, Scarpinato acknowledged that the constitutional ban probably wasn't necessary. He said there are provisions in SB 1070 that effectively mirror what Ducey wanted to take to the ballot. These involve barring local governments from refusing to share information or to collaborate with the federal government in determining whether someone is in the country illegally. The only thing the proposal would have gained was to enshrine that wording in the AZ Constitution, precluding any city from adopting such policies. Here's where I come down on it. Politics are so often about brand. Business is so often about brand. Economic development is so often about brand. In my mind, and I felt this when I was at the State of the City, I was there, and you could feel in the room when Governor Doug Ducey got to the sanctuary city part. You could tell it was not received well. In my mind, this legislation stirred a pot that did need to be stirred. It stirred an issue that has been closed by Arizona's major cities time and time again. Phoenix turned it down. Flagstaff didn't go anywhere with it. Tucson actually voted on it, and it lost 70 to 30%. It was an unnecessary poke in the eye to me that was icing on the cake to make a point that didn't need to be made. Here's how I also see it. I have a lot of friends who fear that Governor Doug Ducey's, in their words, backing down from putting this issue on the ballot to be voted on to enshrine it in the Constitution is reopening the door to sanctuary city advocates to restart the process across the state. I actually think it's reverse. I think forcing the issue in the first place already did that. In the age of populism, politics often makes bad policy. The state's three major cities brought this forward to the political powers that be, and whether it was the voter or the city council, it was turned down every time. In a contentious election with hundreds of thousands of dollars spent, Tucson also closed the door. To me, the conversation was over. And if you're in Tucson, between November and January or February, did you hear anything after the first week or so about this gearing up again? I mean, there was talk about it, but it died. Did you hear anything else about it until it came up in State of the State? In a world where things are so much about brand, or things are so much about perception, I think that the fact that this was taken off the ballot does two things. Doesn't brand the city in a way that it doesn't need to be branded, or the state in a way that it doesn't need to be branded, and really didn't do anything legislatively. The protections or the challenge to sanctuary city, depending on what side of the spectrum you come at it, is SB 1070. And until SB 1070 is repealed, or as long as it is in place, the protections Governor Doug Ducey is looking for whatever reason he is, are already in place. It was a pot that did not need to be stirred. That's my take. Let's go to a quick break. 790-2040. You're listening to 1030 The Voice. Give me a call. Let me know what you think. When we come back, we'll talk about how millennials are actually showing loyalty to employers more than the generation before them. We'll also talk about Bernie, top of the ticket, and why doesn't he talk about the numbers of his plan? So much more left to go here on Tipping Point with Zach Yenser. We'll be right back.
We're the place where Tucson comes to talk. 1030, The Voice.
It's that time of year. Everyone hates it. It's tax time. But there's no reason to stress. Shanae and the team at Simply Bookkeeping and Taxes can take care of it all for you and make it simple and easy. For Tipping Point listeners only, Shanae is offering a one-time special offer of 50% off your personal or business tax prep. Call 520-838-0856 and let her know Zach sent you to get started.
I'm Zach Yenser, host of Tipping Point. We know that one out of every four persons in Tucson is living in poverty. I'm pleased to be partnering with Impact of Southern Arizona, a nonprofit that works to stabilize families and guide and support them on pathways out of poverty. Celebrating their 20th anniversary, they've invested $22 million into the community and are just getting started. Head to impactsoaz.org for more information and to explore how you can get a credit on your state taxes this year by supporting them. As always, talk to your tax professional.
When did you lose control? Was it when you became a number and not a person? Or was it when you accepted that this is just the way things are? Truth is, you didn't lose control. You gave it up. Because you have a choice. You can make them too big to fail and fail to belong to something bigger. Or you can put your money where your values lie and make your community too strong to fail. The choice is yours. Or are you going to give that up too? Vantage West. Banks own you. You own us.
Federally insured by NCUA.
This is The Voice, 1030, Tucson's trusted news and talk.
Tucson, we're back. Welcome back to the 1030 The Voice studio. You're listening to Tipping Point with Zach Yenser, and we're continuing our usual Monday flow, talking about the people, ideas, and issues shaping Tucson's future. We talked about my take on the sanctuary city ban that was being proposed as a constitutional amendment, basically to enshrine in the Arizona Constitution that Arizona will not allow cities to pursue sanctuary status. And it was after a lot of complaints from the right and the left, was pulled off the legislative agenda, will not be pursued. Kind of a hot topic that came in over the end of the week, last week, and we talked about it. Real quick, I want to apologize to you as a millennial. I want to apologize that our generation has taken up so many decades of media time. It's kind of ridiculous. It's not my fault, but it's somebody's fault, and I want to apologize to you for it. But I'm gonna get back in those waters and share a quick story with you that I thought was really interesting. That data is showing that millennials are showing loyalty to employers. They're not hopping around any more than the prior generation was. I know. What fun is it to talk about millennials if the sky isn't falling in? But younger employees are now entering their prime working years. Who are doing that are so far proving as loyal to employers as the generation before them, despite a hot job market. Here's the data. In January 2018, 70% of workers between the ages of 22 and 37, commonly known as the millennial generation, had worked for their current employer for 13 months or more, according to an analysis of federal data by the Pew Research Center. By comparison, that number was 69% for workers who were in the same age group in 2002 and are known as Generation X. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 28.8% of workers aged 25 to 34, those workers are now 27 to 36, or 36, had worked for the same employer for at least 5 years. The share of workers in that age group with equal tenure in 2000 was 21.8%. was 21.8%. This is really interesting. Prudential, the insurance company, found nearly 60% of millennials had worked for their current employer for 3 or more years, and 49% wanted to work for their employer for at least another 4. The loyalty among younger workers contradicts a persistent myth among some job recruiters that millennials are more eager to switch jobs. Well, so here's the punchline. There's two sides of the coin on this, and I won't read the rest, but what this little news tidbit I came across talked about, I think it's an interesting piece of the story, is that we actually have a really hot job market that a lot more people want to be involved in, right? If that makes sense, that not only that, but we are actually underemployed in some sectors, meaning there's lots of jobs to be had, not enough trained employees to fill them. I think the two combine to mean that if you are a millennial in your job today, there's 5 other millennials who want your job and who want the other job that you would go to if you wanted to leave your current job. So I think it speaks to the strength of some pieces of the economy, that there's a retention component because of our hot job markets. I thought that was interesting. When millennials do move on, why do they move on? This article pointed out something interesting, and that is how high or how low is the ceiling? Let me just give this piece of advice if I'm synthesizing from the article. If you're running a business in Tucson, small business, mid-sized business, large business, your millennial employees statistically are more likely to stay longer. That's good news. Why they will leave is if they feel they have exhausted their learning experience and feel capped out at their job. If millennials are being presented, that's going to take 15 years to move from an entry-level job to a mid-level job, or the learning or the skill development or the opportunity to grow is capped out, that's when they'll leave. So, good news, millennials aren't any better or worse than Generation X. In fact, they're maybe a little bit better. And if you're in management and listening right now, you're probably Gen X. It's that kind of 40s to 60 year range is Generation X. Your millennial employees will probably stick around longer, but they'll leave if they feel capped out. So keep that education and upskilling going, and you'll have happy employees. When we come back from a bottom of the hour news and sponsor message break, we'll talk about Bernie atop the Democratic field, the Nevada results from the weekend, and why is Bernie so cautious to talk about the numbers related to his plan for healthcare or otherwise. We'll get into it when we come back from the break as a part of our Decision 2020 analysis here on 1030 The Voice and Tipping Point. I'm Zach Yenser. We'll be right back.
CBS News at the top and bottom of every hour. 1030 The Voice, Tucson's trusted local news and talk.
Today's hot real estate market comes with its own challenges. If you're trying to buy a home, you have to move fast or it's gone fast. Selling your home, that's just always a hassle. But it doesn't have to be your experience. My friend Jason Carlton is a real estate consultant servicing the Tucson metro area. His passion is to help families sell and buy homes with expertise, genuine care, and responsiveness. Feel free to call or text him with any real estate needs to get started. 520-310-6761.
So many of you listening right now are leading a successful and growing business here in Tucson. You know it depends on finding and keeping the right talent. Doing it right can help you stand out and have an edge as a leading employment brand. Wing it, and you might see a great candidate head to a competitor. The Talent Store has helped local Tucson companies like yours win the battle for talent through their recruiting services and consulting. Whether you're looking for a high-level leader, filling a key position, or just want to retain and develop your current team, visit yourtalentstore.com today for a free consultation.
Tucson, Tipping Point is proud to have Why I Love Where I Live as a sponsor of our program. It's a brand and movement that began here in Tucson to spark gratitude and celebrate the good things about where we live. Visit their shop filled with locally designed goods and resources to encourage an appreciation and curiosity about what makes Tucson special and unique. Located at the MSA Annex just west of I-10 and Congress, find more details and shop hours at their website, whyiloveWhereILive.com.
Tucson's source for trusted news and talk. 1030, The Voice.
Tucson, welcome back to Tipping Point. I'm your host, Zach Yenser, speaking to you from the beautiful 1030, The Voice studios right here in Tucson, Arizona. Welcome back after bottom of the hour messages and news. We are walking through our usual Monday. We talk about people, ideas, and issues shaping Tucson's future coming out of the weekend. In our first segment, we talked about the recent drama in the state legislature around the sanctuary city ban that Governor Doug Ducey said was a legislative priority for him this year. It really never got off the ground, in part due to immigrant groups protesting, but also business interests in the state of Arizona expressed some satisfaction that it, or at least gratitude that it didn't. So we talked all about that and my take of why legislatively it stirred a pot that didn't need to be stirred. And so I'll leave it there. If you missed it, head back to the podcast at kvy.com/podcasts or go to Google Play Music or iTunes to check it out as well. And we also talked about, this is good news for many of you who run businesses in Tucson, newsflash, millennials are showing loyalty to employers. I know the conversation is not as fun if millennials are not bringing the sky down and ending the world as we know it, but the fact of the matter is that millennials are actually sticking around their employers at a rate that is even a little bit higher than Gen X before them. And chances are, if you're between 40 and 60, or 40 and 50, 55, you're part of the Gen X generation, probably managing those companies. So you turned out okay. I think millennials are going to turn out okay as well. That's generally how it works. So interesting side note there. In part, I think, due to an economy that is, in terms of the job market, doing pretty well right now. I think the tight job market is keeping people in place more than otherwise. So we covered that before the break. But over the weekend, we like to talk about what happened over the weekend. Bernie Sanders, in a still crowded Democratic field, came out on top in Nevada. And there's a couple interesting things about that, right? There's 6 to 7 major candidates that are still running for president on the Democratic side who are at least going to the debate stage, on the ballot, so on and so forth. Of course, Mike Bloomberg, who was on the debate stage last week on the Democratic debate, but is not on the ballot in Nevada, not on the ballot in South Carolina, which is next week. He is basically, his play is Super Tuesday in March, where a bunch of states hold primaries and you get a real good picture of where the nation as a whole is in terms of selecting a Democratic nominee. But I think the last counts that were up was Bernie Sanders was between 45% and 47% of the Nevada vote. Biden was second, way back at, I think, sub 20%. Buttigieg was right behind him. Elizabeth Warren right behind Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar pulling up the rear. And a lot of people have said, well, you know, is it a crowded field? Is it a crowded race? What if, you know, all the moderates except one dropped out? What if Tom Steyer dropped out? I did the quick math, non-scientific, but I looked at how the other 5 or 6 candidates all added up. And I think if you added everybody up, and, you know, like, for example, you took Joe Biden, almost 20%, you added up everybody else's results, you still would barely get to 45 to 47%. So even if there was two candidates in the field, and even with a fellow progressive in the field still with Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders far and away came out on top. Here's the other thing before I get into what I wanted to get into. This is important. I think it's telling as well. And I think we should try to stop and make sure that we're not making the same Howard Dean mistake. And I use mistake lightly. You know, Howard Dean, what was that, back 2004, was far and away the favorite in the race. I mean, absolutely unstoppable. And then he did the, and we're going to go to Washington, hi-ya! You know, he did that and dropped like a rock after that. But for a while, he looked like the could-not-be-stopped favorite in the race. And of course, it turned out to be John Kerry. So Bernie's got, what, 35-ish delegates? It was a good day for him on Saturday in Nevada, but he's got to get almost 2,000 delegates. So we are a long way away from the end of this thing. But for all intents and purposes, I think Bernie is going to win the majority of the rest of the races. I think he's going to be the nominee. That is just my guess looking at the field. He's proving himself with Latino voters, with African American voters, with white progressive voters. You have to have that coalition in the Democratic Party. Biden thought he had it, doesn't have it. I don't think he's going to get it back. I think we see all that we need to see here. And I think the example of that was interesting, right, is the Culinary Union in Nevada. This made big news. The Culinary Union said that we're not going to endorse one of the biggest unions in Nevada. I think there's 60,000 people strong, massive union, and they usually come out. Although I don't think they did in the last election either. But they usually come out. They endorse a candidate. 60,000 people makes a big difference. One of the biggest unions in Nevada. This year, they decided not to endorse anybody on the Democratic side, except they kind of did. Right, they laid into Sanders' plan. They said, "We've got a great healthcare plan through the union. Why would we want somebody to come in, take that away, and put us all on a single payer system? It doesn't make sense to us. We like our plan. We're a union. We fight for our workers. We like it the way it is." And they said, "We kind of like Elizabeth Warren's plan a little better, but we're not going to endorse anybody." Which to me, come on, is an endorsement. It's an endorsement, but they didn't endorse anybody. So all this drama last week, right? I'll get to my point in a second. And a lot of Bernie supporters on Twitter are going after the Culinary Union, blah, blah, blah. Well, it all ended up being moot on Saturday evening when Nevada actually went to the polls. Bernie Sanders did extremely well with union workers of the Culinary Union in Nevada. And what was interesting is that the union workers who believe that they have got a great healthcare plan still were saying, wait a second, we've got family members that don't have great health care, and we're kind of worried about them too. So you have this massive union. The leadership says, we're not going to endorse anybody, but we're going to make it clear how much we don't like Bernie's plan. But the union workers that are part of the union came out for him in droves. And so what I just think that's interesting because it shows in some ways how detached often organizational leadership and polling is from the reality on the ground. And so I actually feel less assured of where I think the race is going to go because of those things. But as I just have processed what looks to be Bernie Sanders on top of the Democratic field, one of the things that I've begun to think about is why, especially on healthcare, right? The number one topic that Nevada voters said mattered to them. Why on healthcare is Bernie Sanders so mum on the cost of a single payer government run healthcare system? Here's an example.
How much will that cost?
Obviously, those are expensive propositions, but we have done our best on issue after issue in paying for them.
Do you know how much, though? I mean, do you have a price tag for all of this?
We do. I mean, you know, and the price tag is, it will be substantially less than letting the current system go. I think it's about $30 trillion.
That's just for Medicare for All?
Just Medicare about. For All. Yes.
Do you have a price tag for all of these things?
No, I don't. You mentioned making public colleges and universities tuition-free and canceling all student debt. That's correct. That's what I want to do. We pay for that through a modest tax on Wall Street speculation.
But you say you don't know what the total price is, but you know how it's going to be paid for. How do you know it's going to be paid for if you don't know how much the price is?
Well, I can't rattle off to you every nickel and every dime, but we have accounted for it.
And this was, this content is no longer available, says Facebook. But hey, we got through, 48 seconds of 51 seconds? We heard what we wanted to hear. Thanks, John. Facebook watches everything. But no, it would be unfair of me to not say that in a recent study when five economists were studied and asked, help us figure out how much a single-payer government-run healthcare system in America, Medicare for all, how much will that cost? Five different economists had basically three to five different senses of how much it would cost. Some said it's going to be less than what we pay now. Some said it's going to be extremely more in terms of government spending. This is not the first time that Bernie Sanders has said, I don't really know and I can't really go into detail. And I guess my two sides of the coin concern with that is he's not wrong in the sense that it's pretty hard to figure out how much this is going to cost. And because of that, that is concerning to me, right? In the sense of you don't get to run for president without knowing your numbers. I actually think the point of concern is that Bernie Sanders is right. There really is no way to figure out exactly how much it's going to cost and exactly how much you're going to save. Nobody knows. Now, what caught my eye with this 60 Minutes interview, you probably recognize the voice of Anderson Cooper, is this is not the first time that Bernie Sanders has not been clear with a reporter on how much things are going to cost. And if it's strategic, so be it. He has seemed to concede in the past that his Medicare for All plan would increase federal spending by somewhere between his, quote, $30 and $40 trillion over a 10-year period. Now, of course, there's a climate plan. There's a government jobs plan. There is student loan forgiveness. There's Social Security. A lot of people add that up to being about $85 to $90 trillion over the next decade. But if we just look at healthcare costs, that's the number. And what is a little concerning to me, even if he's speaking the truth, right, is Elizabeth Warren, for example, even though it took a while, finally came out with a healthcare plan that will at least cost $20 million. And at least from a brand perspective, right, when you hear Elizabeth Warren talk, at least she says, I want to do a 2% wealth tax. Like, you at least know where she's planning to get the money from. You can agree or disagree with her. And in fact, I'm always, you know this, more than open to having a policy-driven conversation. Healthcare is broken in this country. Everybody knows that. These are big problems we have to take care of. I'm happy to have the policy conversation. I get to be concerned when we don't know how much it's going to cost and we're not clear necessarily on where it's going to come from. Just give me those numbers and I'm okay. We can go from there. The other real quick number that I've been hearing out there that doesn't make sense to me. I'll just be honest. I'm not going to come out as the expert on this. I just see this number and the math doesn't work for me. A new study estimates that Medicare for All would save $450 billion a year and prevent 68,000 unnecessary deaths each year. School me up. This is an actual invitation. 790-2040. I don't want to have a blind spot on this, right? I'm a curious observer and a curious explainer, right, at this point. Even if you save $450 billion a year over 10 years, that's shy of $5 trillion. If over the next 10 years, implementing Medicare for All is going to cost $30 to $40 trillion a year, I don't necessarily understand why that $450 billion number is a good number. It sounds like it's apples and oranges to me. I heard a conversation the other day, right? Some will say, well, look, what Bernie Sanders wants to do is to basically reallocate the money we already have, right? A defense budget would be less under Bernie Sanders, and probably so. But if you listen closely to his interviews, he's pretty clear. He's not a pacifist. He's not looking to not go to war. I heard an interview this weekend. He's very clear. Look, we got to be ready. We got to have a military. I'm not a pacifist. I just don't want to be as involved as other presidents have been. I want to stay out of foreign policy. So he's not anti-having a military. And we know that defense spending is the biggest, by far, chunk of spending in the country. Here's my last number as I'm processing. What does a Bernie Sanders atop the Democratic ticket look like and mean without feeling like there's a boogeyman around the corner? And this is my last number, and we'll go to a quick break. Here's what I found about some of the countries that we refer to when we talk about having a free market system underpinned by a strong social safety net. And that's my definition, by the way, of democratic socialism, is a free market economy underpinned by a strong social safety net. As opposed to socialism. I get really buggy about those terms. But listen to this. Finland's has a 57% government spending as compared to GDP. More simply said, what percentage of GDP is government spending? Finland's is 57%. France is pretty close to that. Denmark is pretty close to that. But Sweden and Norway spend just under 50% of GDP. Right now, the U.S. government spends between 34% and 38% of GDP. Some estimate that Medicare for All, the entire cost of Bernie Sanders' dream package of kind of a little bit shy of $100 trillion over the next 10 to 15 years, would make U.S. government spending 70% of the projected GDP over 10 years. So again, am I an expert on these topics? I wouldn't tell you that I am. But I think it's interesting when we think about what are we going to spend, even in the near term, compared to our economic gross domestic product. How do we compare to some of these countries that we think about when we talk about socialism or democratic socialism? If Sweden and Norway spend just under 50% of GDP, would we be doing a good job if we spent 70% of GDP? I don't personally think so, but just an observation. Again, I hate boogeyman politics. I'm not about it. I want it to be numbers-based. And I think that's my continued thought is, Bernie, show me, show us the numbers. Let's have a policy conversation about the numbers. But the numbers have not been clear. And I think atop the ticket, it's time for those numbers to become clear. That's my take on that. Let's go to our last quick break of the hour. When we come back, we'll see what we can get into about the Californication of housing. Why does affordable housing cost $750,000 to build in California? We'll be right back. 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk.
CBS News at the top and bottom of every hour. 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk.
So many of you listening right now are leading a successful and growing business here in Tucson. You know it depends on finding and keeping the right talent. Doing it right can help you stand out and have an edge as a leading employment brand. Wing it, and you might see a great candidate head to a competitor. The Talent Store has helped local Tucson companies like yours win the battle for talent through their recruiting services and consulting. Whether you're looking for a high-level leader, filling a key position, or just want to retain and develop your current team, visit yourtalentstore.com today for a free consultation.
I'm Zach Yenser, host of Tipping Point. We know that one out of every four persons in Tucson is living in poverty. I'm pleased to be partnering with Impact of Southern Arizona, a nonprofit that works to stabilize families and guide and support them on pathways out of poverty. Celebrating their 20th anniversary, they've invested $22 million into the community and are just getting started. Head to impactsoaz.org for more information and to explore how you can get a credit on your state taxes this year by supporting them. As always, talk to your tax professional.
When did you lose control? Was it when you became a number and not a person? Or was it when you accepted that this is just the way things are? Truth is, you didn't lose control. You gave it up. Because you have a choice. You can make them too big to fail and fail to belong to something bigger. Or you can put your money where your values lie and make your community too strong to fail. The choice is yours. Or are you going to give that up too?
Vantage West. Banks own you. You own us.
Federally insured by NCUA.
It's that time of year. Everyone hates it. It's tax time. But there's no reason to stress. Shanae and the team at Simply Bookkeeping and Taxes can take care of it all for you and make it simple and easy. For Tipping Point listeners only, Shanae is offering a one-time special offer of 50% off your personal or business tax prep. Call 520-838-0856 and let her know Zach sent you to get started.
Trusted local news and talk all day, every day. 1030 The Voice.
Tucson, welcome back into our final segment of the hour here of Tipping Point Daily. In-depth news and discussion about the people, ideas, and issues shaping Tucson's future. Tipping Point listeners, so many of you are leaders in successful and growing businesses right here in Tucson. You know that continued growth and success depends on finding and keeping the right talent. Here's an interesting little tidbit. As larger companies come into our market and the talent pool continues to tighten, organizations that approach talent attraction, acquisition, and retention as a holistic strategy will stand out and have an edge as a leading employment brand. The Talent Store, founded by my friend Devin Underwood, has helped local companies like yours win the battle for talent through their recruiting services and talent strategy consulting. Whether you're looking to bring on a high-level leader or fill in a key management position, or you just want to retain and develop your current leadership and current teams, don't wing it. For more information, visit yourtalentstore.com and schedule a free consultation. The Talent Store is where thought leadership, opportunity, and talent connect to create growth. This segment is sponsored by The Talent Store. So one item that we wanted to talk about, and we're coming down to the wire here, but read an article this week. I'll just touch on it briefly and probably more later this week, is the fact that even affordable housing in California is reaching astronomic costs, And I think a lot of people think about, well, how do we get more housing? But not enough people think about how do we create more housing that is affordable enough to the person developing it, whether it's private or public, you know, government development, so that less costs are trickled down to the person who is living there. There's a whole process to this. And the article talked about how in California, over-regulation and also some of the rules put in place, actually, I think during the Reagan administration, which was interesting to me to read that, basically allowing for a very low barrier of entry, the halting of new development. Back in the day, it was designed with environmental causes in mind. Again, Ronald Reagan's California, a lot of development at that time, some environmental concerns. So they put in place ways to check development, make sure development is good development, create regulations, create different layers. And it's really beginning to be a story of good intentions going bad, where too many stops and starts, too much regulation has caused the cost of building to go up so high that when it comes to the cost of living, it has to be high as well. But let me give you this. This is out of The Economist earlier this year, which is a center-right global publication. But I thought this was interesting. I read this and I thought, wow, this explains why we're at where we are at. And that is the post-recession global real house prices have risen since the recession by 15%, taking them well past their pre-crisis peak. The costs are just too dang high. Between 2000 and 2007, America's household debt rose from 104% of household income to 144%. House prices rose by 50% in real terms. Here's a couple lines I thought were interesting. Housing is a big reason, quote, why many people across the rich world feel that the economy does not work for them. Whereas baby boomers tend to own big, expensive houses, youngsters must increasingly rent somewhere cramped with their friends, fomenting millennials' resentment of the system. Right? I talk about housing a lot. It is an issue I care about deeply, but not always from the angle that traditionally people talk about it. If you want to know, in part, why there is generational stress, why there is a growth of populism, why Bernie Sanders resonates so deeply, why the narrative of our 2020 election is the way it is, why there are some people that say the economy is buzzing, never been better, and so many people say it hasn't worked better for me in a really long time. In so many ways, you can circle back to the fact that housing costs way too dang much to build and way too dang much to buy or rent. Other research, it continues, has found that housing is behind some of the biggest political shocks of recent years. Housing markets and populism are closely linked. Britons living in areas where house prices are stagnant were more likely to vote for Brexit in 2016. French people for the far-right National Front in the presidential elections of 2017. Fascinating stuff. It's why we talk about it on the air, because in communities where the housing policy and housing supply is not right, things don't work. I don't care how good the economy is. If you don't get housing right, you don't get much else right. So I thought that would be interesting. We talk about it a lot on the air because it is a human issue. It is an economic issue. It is an opportunity issue. Tucson, when we come back, our Tuesday show is Tech and Tacos on Taco Tuesday, one of our favorite shows. We'll talk to another high-growth startup in Tucson for the whole hour. Bill Buckmaster at noon. Tucson, we'll see you back on Tipping Point at 9.
KVOI Cortero, AM 1030, the voice of Tucson. Trusted local news and talk. A Bustos Media Station.